Hey, Derek here. Just to let you know that today's episode includes one or two swear words. So if you're listening with smallies, it might be good to cover their ears or listen later when they're not around. Of Studios in Dublin, welcome to Mother Folklore, a podcast about words.
Irish
words.
And words from Ireland.
I'm Patrick Kavanagh.
No, you're not. I am. But you are Derek O'Shea.
I surely am. Patrick, I was recently overhearing some colleagues having a very bitter argument.
Oh no. What was it about?
Well, it was about, one of them was giving out about his daughter and her friends. And the Americanisms they were using.
Shock, horror. Oh no. Not Americanisms.
Well, first of all, he's saying.
That's whack.
It's on a whacker fod.
It's not fly.
It's.
At all. I'm actually struggling to think of modern Americanisms. Most of mine come from the Fresh Prince of Bel Air.
Completely. But this is the thing, and it's a funny one because he was first of all giving out about his daughter talking in this very Kardashian esque vocal fry. He even knew what the word vocal fry was.
Vocal fry.
And I mean, I was... Okay.
That's where you sound like you're a balloon that's deflating.
Somewhat, apparently so. I'm still learning about these things. But then he was recounting that she was using some words that, you know, that she didn't pick up in Ballybrack.
Which words? Okay, go on. You have to hit me with this. Which words was she using?
She... who was, you know, raised proper Dublin girl, had suddenly started referring to her mother as her mom.
I know. That's a really Dublin-centric attitude to take. Like, you know, I have a lot of cousins from Waterford. My family on my mother's side is from Waterford, and most of them would refer to their mammies as mom, their mom.
This is the thing. So there are a number of Americanisms. Language moves both ways. We, as has been well discussed, there is cast iron proof that Irish people invented all American slang.
Oh, Christ.
Oh man. I can hear a blog post being written angrily.
Oh, no, that was an aneurysm happening inside my brain. Oh, not this again.
But that we can leave that for another day because
we've already done it.
Exactly.
We've had the conversation about this.
The other day,
go back to season one. It's bullshit. Jazz is not Irish. Right? Jazz is not Irish. It's bullshit. There are some terms that are probably Irish, like phony has a good chance of being Irish. We did this. We did this in season one. It's done. Draw a line under it. Language goes both ways. What came over here?
So this is the thing. The internet, one of the things with the internet is, and people have been wondering, is it destroying or is it changing regional slangs? And some of this, the idea is that, say, we're familiar, most people come from a county that has a certain amount of local regional slang. Certain words go from their region to become national or global.
Oh, like shifting.
Like shifting.
Like shifting. Well, you did a good article. Segue, I know, but you did a good article on the origins of the word shift. And you almost narrowed it down, but not quite.
This is the thing. This is the thing, because I often think, you know, when you look at the kind of, when people look at the etymologies of certain words, and we're going to talk about some of those, they say, well, this is all the evidence we have. And there's a big issue saying, is the first recorded use of shifting, meaning to kiss, does that demonstrably prove that person invented the word at that spot, or could you interpret 20 or 30 of years?
Yeah, I get you. So how long does something have to be in slang before it's recorded? And it's kind of different these days because the internet is where you tend to see most of it. So like stuff makes it to the Oxford English Dictionary a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. Like within a year of the first recorded usage, you're seeing stuff make it into the Oxford Dictionary. There's that usual article every year. It's like, oh, we've added selfie to the dictionary. It's like, shut up, dictionary man, you're not cool.
And you'll never be cool. You must have known that when you applied for the job of the dictionary. But... but shifting, yeah. So from my research, I think it's a Munsterism, probably Kerry, Tipperary, Limerick area, and for some reason it spread in a way that other terms for kissing didn't.
Mm.
But in that,
probably because the rest of them are obscene.
Getting the where.
Getting your where. Yeah.
And this is the thing.
Meeting. It was meeting when I was growing up.
What outraged some Cork people recently was the idea that Dublin people invented langer and stopped saying it.
That is controversial.
we got over it. It's like, and for example, even this in The Snapper, the book of The Snapper, Roddy Doyle does have a character refer to someone having a big langer, a Dublin character, and it's not, it is no reference to any contact with Cork in it.
I think, to be honest with you, like, langer is just used in a sense in Cork that, like, it's much broader.
Yeah.
You know, the way it's used, like, it's almost like they had a song, they had a hit song, The Langer, you know? You know, and like, you wouldn't get, like, you know, you wouldn't have a hit song called The Prick. Like, you know what I mean? So it's not an identical usage. Like, you know, yeah. there was always sort of two terms stuck out in mind. Like langer was slang term for a penis in Dublin for as long as I can remember. And also langered. Getting langered meant getting drunk. But it really wasn't used in the same context as somebody who, you know, makes a mistake or actually eats it or anything like that. It's like, oh, you're langer. It just wasn't used the same way. And it just, maybe there are certain slang terms that just lend themselves to an accent or a dialect much easier. And I just think it sounds so natural to have someone, particularly from Cork City, to call you a langer, like.
Completely. And it suits them. And there's something I've always been thinking can you interpret the growth of the spread of a word, a slang word, from saying it's first usage, so some genius came up with this idea and then everyone else who started using it, isn't it quite possible that a bunch of people all started using text as a verb independent of each other?
Of course it's possible, yeah, because like text makes sense, doesn't it?
Hmm.
You know, I remember like texting, the act itself, sending an SMS message, it was far more popular over here than it was in the US, for example, you know, because over there it costs money to both send and receive a text message, whereas local calls on your house phone were free.
Yeah.
So you just wouldn't do it. But then the mobile phone became ubiquitous, it became a lot less expensive, and texting became part of the vernacular. But for a long, long time, American friends of mine were saying, I'll text message you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the desire to verb a noun it's huge. It's incredibly strong. Well, yeah, I mean, is it entirely possible that people came up with shifting simultaneously? I don't know if it's that obvious, you know.
No.
I don't know. But so it kind of, it's a horses for courses thing. It depends on the verb. To me, text just seems so intuitive because it's a text message.
Yeah.
I'll text it to you.
And it is. And also, when you look at the actual, one of the reasons we actually do have an origin moment, there's a song called by an artist called Moose T, a German DJ, which is recorded in maybe 1998. It's called Horny.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This is when Brian puts in a bit of it. And in the song.
Just in case he doesn't.
Yeah.
I'm horny. Horny, horny, horny.
I was
so horny. Horny, horny, horny tonight.
I was working at a petrol station, the KCR, the summer that came out. And I remember it was on the radio. And a man who's looking at some videos in the video shop was like, I thought this is a family store. Because I write the lyrics to all the songs on the radio.
I thought this was it.
It's like, I'm not spinning the decks for you here, man.
That's... did not realize this was a horny petrol station.
Well, he didn't know how right he was. But as it happens, in the song, the singer of the song, she lists a number of ways in which she tries to get contact with the man or woman, who knows, the person she wants to get horny with. And she says that she tries to ring him on the phone. She sends a message on the internet. She,
I IM'd you.
She lists all these things, but she significantly does not list texting or sending a text message. Whereas a short 2 or 3 years later, I believe Craig David referred to texting in one of his lyrics in probably around 2001.
Yeah, so... In Hot and Juicy and Moose T's magnum opus, Horny, she tries to call you, but she cannot find the telephone. She sent a message to the internet, but it rejected. And then amazingly, she wrote a letter and sent it in the post, but the post would take so long, so I've got to sing this song.
Well, you know, when you're that horny, you'll try anything.
I'm so horny, I'm relying on post to get the ride.
Ta Arkham. Arkham.
Oh my god. Have you ever been so horny that you wrote a letter?
Can you imagine what that letter was like? Ride me now.
Well, I kept knocking the writing table out of the way, like I await your response. Yours.
I remain your obedient servant.
Well, you know, you can write that, I suppose, if you, you know.
In the context.
If you've got the GIMP mask on.
Oh, God, well. So, it's agreed anyway.
So Craig David invented texting, is what you're saying, well, in a nutshell.
One of the first recorded instances of, and there's a wonderful podcast, which many of you will enjoy, by James McWhorter in Slate magazine called Lexicon Valley. And he frequently uses the lyrics to Broadway tunes to demonstrate the development of slang and slang usage. And he shows how these things go. And I was inspired by that to look at how, you know, when do people start referring to texting? And because texting revolutionized flirting, and texting is central to the kind of the nerd culture revolution, because people like me who are too shy to ask people out could suddenly text them and ask you out by text, and suddenly nerds were scoring because of the text message.
That is...
Or getting girlfriends anyway.
Yeah.
Or boyfriends.
You know, I mean...
It's my theory. I stand by it. I live through it.
I mean, how successful were you at texting people and asking them out?
Here's the thing. I used to be that I, you know, there was... See, I feel like Mel Brooks and the 2000-year-old man when I talk about the 90s. But like, so yeah, it used to be in the old days, you'd ring the house. The father or the mother, or possibly an older sibling, which is actually the worst situation because they start doing the slags. I want to ask Anya Mara and McGillicuddy out. So I ring up the house and I was like, good afternoon, Mr. McGillicuddy.
Hello.
May I speak to Anya Mara, please?
Who is this?
Hi, my name is Derek.
Are your intentions as towards my daughter?
but then, so I make a bit of small talk. One of the things was, and I realized one of the things that possibly got from going to Gonzaga is you could always make small talk about school rugby, which all the dads followed, even if they had no sons, which is really weird. I never got it. I never got the idea that, like, a man who lived across the road had five daughters, who was all... he was always trying to get information from me on school's rugby because he would make this banter with other businessmen in his office.
He was trying to find husbands for his daughters.
So I see Zag have been knocked out again. Which is, you know, yeah.
Whoa,
it's terrible. Black Rock are looking really bad this year. The Rock are looking bad this year.
And what would you do if you had to ring a household that was, for argument's sake, say, not full of twats?
Well, you know, growing up in Sudoku, I'd never met that.
See, you got it wrong. Like, you don't make small talk with the dad. You don't make small talk with the mom. You certainly don't make small talk with the older sibling. You just keep ringing until the apple of your eye answers. And if it's the wrong person, you hang up. Well, you just keep doing that. And I went through a lot of 20 pence pieces using the payphone in the middle center.
That's the fourth verse of Horny that didn't get released. I was at the payphone outside Mr. Lamb's.
Oh, no, come on now. Way back then, Mr. Lamb's is called the Ocean Palace.
Oh, God, where are you?
Yeah, Mr. Lamb hasn't been there forever.
No?
And the funny thing was, my mate Liam, his house phone number was one digit removed from the Ocean Palace. So occasionally people would ring up and he just, for shits and giggles, if he answered the phone, he'd go, Ocean Palace. And if it was a wrong number, he would just take their order. And then leave them waiting for their Chinese. It was kind of cruel, actually.
That is, because Ocean Palace are the ones who get that in the neck afterwards.
Yeah. In hindsight, it was a really, really awful prank. Mm. It was hilarious at the time, though.
Well, my friend Aiden, what a really awful prank is when he had a voicemail on his phone. What he did was he recorded his voicemail messages. Hi. I can't hear you. Hi. I can't hear you. Hi. And then people thought that he was just there. And then they actually just put through the machine. And I was like,
boop. Yeah, it was literally everyone did that at one stage. When I was a teenager, there was this number doing the rounds. You should ring. People saying, ring this number here, ring this number there.
Oh, yeah.
And it would go straight to a voicemail. And the voicemail was a man singing. It was, Anne-Marie is not here and Noel is gone. Leave a message, I won't be long. I'm not at the pub and I'm not with the men. I'm up in Muller Castle looking after a hen. Beep. And then it's like, the voicemail box is full because it's just full of fuckers ringing it and going, deadly.
I remember that. And I remember a few elections back, you might be interested as a man with an interest in elections, as a candidate who's running in a Dublin called Noel Ivory. And Noel Ivory, you might remember, it was a guy who's, you know, he was impressive. He cut a dash in a kind of a patterned jumper against an Ivory Coast flag. And he basically his whole election campaign was he had a voicemail number, a mobile phone number, he'd ring it and he'd be there on the phone. Girls Just Want to Have Fun was playing in the background for some reason, and he was shouting to the phone saying, "You elect me, I'm going to come here, I'm going to clean up this town, I'm going to clean up Bertie's mess." And he'd just list off various things, but he clearly was a little, and how shall I put this? He was in an advanced state of refreshment.
That's potentially defamatory.
No, he was
tired and emotional.
I've been trying to try to find this clip on YouTube ever since, but I remember we would listen to this clip, and you know, he didn't do terribly well in the election. Like, he certainly didn't get elected, and some people say it's much of a muchness whether you just miss out or whether you get 42 votes, which I think he did.
I don't know. Like, there's speaking as someone who didn't miss out, I know that if I had just missed out, I'd be like, oh, you know what? That was close. I think people are really interested in what I have to say, and I'll give it a rattle. I'll refine my message. I'll talk to more people. I'll go at it again the next time out. If I got 42 votes, I wouldn't want to hear the word politics again. you know what? Actually, this is not for me. This has very quickly become two dads reminiscing about when you didn't have mobile phones, but we were talking about Americanisms at one stage.
Yes, and in some ways, we're going to point out that text isn't an Americanism, but
we had it first.
Yeah, so one thing though that, and we're also going to point out that mom is actually how the letters M-A-M are pronounced, Oscalia.
Yeah, it is, because it's your mommy.
Mommy.
You know, and that's probably why in Munster, it's mom. More often than it's ma'am. Yeah. Definitely more often than it's ma.
That's for sure. That's much ma'am there. And mummy, how are you in the mummy business?
Peppa Pig is bringing mummy back with a vengeance, and I'm not happy with these developments.
We, as fathers, we are concerned with the Peppa Pigification of Irish childhood. But it's bad enough, you know, I think the thing is, Peppa Pig, I mean, there's a cartoon called Masha and the Bear, which my daughter loves. It is her favorite cartoon. It is made in Russia. Yeah. It is banned in several...
Putinist propaganda.
This is the thing. It's banned in certain East European countries for being Putinist propaganda. The implication is the bear represents all the kind of the fine qualities of Russianness. He minds his own business. Hibernation isn't a state of laziness. It's basically a state of acknowledgement that winter is coming and your life is all about preparation. The bear is always preparing. He's always minding his own business. He's always preparing. But if anybody interferes, he gets very, very annoyed. And, you know, he deals with the situation decisively.
And Masha interferes.
But Masha is a different form of Russianness in that she owns the world. Just the world hasn't realized it yet. So, between these two, this dichotomy this double whammy is out there. So, people are in East Europe. They're saying they're concerned that this is actually subtle Russian propaganda. But I would consider that maybe Peppa Pig has maybe deeper and more sinister propagandist.
You think it's British imperialist propaganda?
They're clearly Tories.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you don't
propaganda, how about that one?
If you listen to the way Grandpa Pig speaks, I mean, there's a kind of a false, there's a false utopia there in the way kind of it seems kind of like a classless society where everyone just gets along. But clearly,
I have not looked this deeply into these programs. Mind you, the only thing I watch with my kid is Thomas the Tank Engine, the occasional episode of Postman Pat.
Oh yeah, there used to be a great dub over a Postman Pat with a Louth accent.
I have not shown him that one yet. Oh, I'm a big fan of Katsahata.
Oh.
Yeah, Katahata. Katahata, actually. Katahata. It's the Irish dub of Dr. Seuss's Cat and Hat. It's on TG Car and it's class.
Excellent, we'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I mean, it's Cat and Hat, it's Dr. Seuss. Like, it's not entirely unproblematic, but it's cool. It's fun colours.
It sure is. But we've drifted a little, but so there's...
Sorry, what Americanisms was this girl using again at the start of the podcast 6 years ago?
Okay, so... So then, one of the Americanisms that that was brought to attention was the idea that men are trash. And the word trash is not a word we use for waste in general. I mean, Irish women have been giving out at Irish men and other men too for, you know, since... For a long time, often with gauze, but the word trash is a fairly recent entry to this.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, it's not that the word trash has entered into the vernacular. It's not like people say, you know, the trash goes out on Wednesday. And, you know, this week it's the green trash bin and next week it'll be the grey trash bin. It's that there's a phrase.
Men are trash.
Yeah. Immortalized by our Shana Corja, Tebby Rex. Have you heard their song, Men Are Trash?
Yes.
Class. It's absolutely brilliant. Mm. Chapter one, Men Are Trash. Yeah, but so it's just a phrase. It's a thing. It's like if you were to say men are rubbish, people would certainly understand what you're talking about, but it wouldn't be very, it wouldn't be very internationally recognized. It wouldn't be very online of you.
This is the thing. And so this in a way, the idea that a word can, as part of an expression can enter a language without actually fully penetrating, men are trash, this way is the same way that we...
What? Fully penetrating.
Fully penetrating. Okay.
No, go on, it's fine.
This is why we in Ireland will still refer to ballpark figures without actually calling Croke Park a ballpark.
They are. Give me a ballpark figure. That really came out of left field. There are loads of baseball euphemisms that have successfully entered the Irish vernacular without, and I say this as a baseball player, without baseball ever becoming popular over here.
It hasn't a good gig. Yeah, it hasn't got a home run yet. But
still stuck at first base.
And this chap, anyway, who's giving out Americanisms, didn't consider the Americanisms he used, such as ballpark figures and you do the math.
Ah, no, I still say you do the maths.
You do the maths.
You do the maths. Because it's maths.
I had a debate with this, and that you don't have one mathematics, and someone said no, it's that mathematics is actually an abbreviation of a larger sentence, which is, you know, problems of mathematics.
All I'm saying is the English translation for Gafalamata was busy at maths. So if it's immortalized in the school books, I'm down with it. If it's there, if it says maths in the school books, which it does, busy at maths, not busy at math.
Busy at math.
Math.
Well, so but people will still feel people say do the math, but because that's so the entire expression does come from the United States. But you're saying do the maths, and you don't say a ballpark figure.
Oh God, no! I say give me a rough estimate.
Yeah, a rough estimate.
Give me a rough estimate. No, ballpark figure. Ballpark figure is fine. Like ballpark figure, and if somebody says, oh yeah, it's in the ballpark of, you know, it's in the region of this. Yeah,
So this is the thing, that Americanisms that come in from political commentary seem to be fine. It's ultimately, this is really, people are concerned with Americanisms that come in from pop culture.
Yeah, it's snobbery, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is lexicographical snobbery.
It is. And the idea is, you know, these are trivial things. And it's that maybe that wouldn't be so bad before, but the idea is that there's such a strong overlap between pop culture or protest culture at the moment that it is... Maybe that people need to revise their separation of those two things and reconsider the snobbery.
Fuck yeah. I get all my news from Teen Vogue.
Don't we all?
It's like, yeah, that's right on. Like, you know, this is pop culture and protest culture. They're totally intertwined, but like they have been before. Like they were before in 1967 to 72, you know, the height of the Vietnam War. Protest songs were incredibly, incredibly big. And they were big over here as well. Like, we fell in love with Dylan and Neil Young, and to a lesser extent, the likes of Barry Maguire. And yet, it was totally, totally intertwined. This idea that the American pop culture we were consuming was this sort of leftist, folk-based anti-war. Mm. So yeah, it has happened like this before. And yet, the same people who grew up in that era are sort of a little bit more, they sort of poo-poo the idea that you might learn something off, you know, off Twitter or off Facebook or something like that.
Yeah, and it's like obviously the Dubliners and to the last extent the Clancy Brothers were very influenced by the various kind of folk traditions in the United States. In that they certainly, I mean, Luke Kelly would have covered a certain number of union protest songs.
Well, definitely, Luke Kelly's version of the Peat Bog Soldiers, which was translated by Pete Seeger and was originally written by. Prisoners in the Spanish Civil War, leftist international brigade prisoners in the Civil War. It was originally Wir sind die Moorsoldaten, and then it became We Are the Peat Bog Soldiers. And Luke Kelly's version is brilliant. Lancome's version is off the charts. It's incredible. It's definitely, hands down, the definitive best version of that song. But yeah, protest music, absolutely. And meshed in with pop culture, absolutely. I suppose, and this is me showing my age, like, where do the Kardashians fit into this equation?
So this is the thing, in that obviously the biggest case of pop culture and politics and activism overlapping is probably is in the world, it must be, has an Irish root, which is Live Aid. But people will now say that Live Aid is kind of overwhelming. We look back into Live Aid now and we see this, maybe there's a problematic, the idea of... White savior complex. The idea of taking a kind of consumerist approach to fixing a problem, particularly the fact that,
look, there's also the elephant in the room is that just Bob Geldof has...
not distinguished himself since.
There you are. That's the diplomatic way of saying it.
It's a funny one because I think on one level we can see that that there are certain issues, conceptual issues with the Live Aid project. We don't think less of George Michael when we find out that he actually signed over all the royalties to Last Christmas to Live Aid.
Why would we think less of him?
Exactly. We think ultimately it's a good thing, even though we think that there's problems with Live Aid. A lot of it is down to we're concerned with Bono and Bob Geldof's use of that platform to do other things.
There was a concert once in Dublin, and Bono was, you two were there, and Bono was there, and he was like, "Every time I snap my fingers, a child in Africa dies." And somebody in the crowd went, "Stop fucking snapping your fingers then."
Oh yeah, I mean, we obviously there's a lot to cover in terms of that, but there's a lot to cover in terms of the Live Aid thing, but suffice to say that at the time the idea was that there was an Irish interest in the famine related
aspect of course to it. It really spoke to who we were, you know. It really reached into our souls. And to be honest with you, problematic as certain methods of delivering foreign aid are, now we're much, much better these days than we were 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we're much, much better these days than we were around the time of Live Aid, which was 34 years ago, was it?
That's right, yeah.
It's, yeah, 1985, was it?
Yeah, the single was Christmas 1984 and then the concert was 1985.
Yeah, so like we're much, much better now. We deliver foreign aid in line with the Sustainable Development Goals, but we're still one of the best countries in the world per capita at donating to foreign charities. So it does speak to a generosity. But I mean, did we pick up money? Did anything enter into our vernacular through Live Aid?
Give us your fucking money.
Apart from give us your fucking money. But I mean, like, we were talking about Americanisms, and it was the transatlantic concert. You know, Phil Collins hopped on a Concorde and, you know, he played both London and Philadelphia. You know, incredible. Mm. Oh my God, amazing. Carbon footprints off the fucking charts. Like, you wouldn't do it now, but at the time, using the information available, that was so cool. Oh my God, amazing. Brilliant. But like, I mean, did it, I know it was like the ultimate crossover of pop culture and protest culture and politics, but did it influence how we speak?
I think it in a way it did, in that it meant that people realized, if you consider, say, that at one point you two were peers to bands like Simple Minds and NXS, but the inclusion of a political dimension actually sustained them in audiences' minds when those other bands kind of just trailed off. The idea was, in order to get from the two successful albums in a row to becoming actual global megastars, people expected pop stars to have a certain social conscience dimension, and they expected that in their lyrics.
So you're saying basically Live Aid gave U2 the social clout to become the biggest band in the world, which they were undoubtedly for a time.
Yeah.
Probably unseated by Green Day in and around their height. But like, yeah, okay.
For me, the idea was, and Green Day as well, the idea, I think, that people, just the same, the idea that, say, people listen to a band, but in order to keep listening to a band three or four albums later, they expect them to have a little bit of something substantial to them.
But that was the Green Day leap, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, one of their albums was called Dookie. Like, literally, they named an album after a shit. Right?
Yeah.
And it was all about weed and masturbating. And then in order to sort of catapult themselves to global superstardom, they delivered American Idiot, which is a more or less a concept album. It's got a 9-minute rock opera in it, and it's about how basically
is it 9 minutes prospect... and 11 seconds? Is it?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure when it came out. So
because Wake Me Up on September Ends is obviously about 9/11.
Yeah.
And
but I mean, yeah, exactly. And you know, it was 9 minutes and 11 seconds. That's very clever. Well done, Billy Joe. But yeah, so they sort of gave themselves that social dimension, and they basically bloomed. They exploded. They became huge. They were massive.
And this is
they were in the Simpsons movie, and we've heard nothing since.
And that's the thing. We have like the police realized that they couldn't just sing in a fake Jamaican accent about prostitutes anymore. Then that Sting needed to find his own cause.
Well, listen, there's only so many times you can play the Roxanne game before your elbow gives out from drinking too much. It's just, you ever played the Roxanne game?
How do I play the Roxanne game?
So when you're at a party and somebody plays Roxanne, right, you divide the room into two teams. You can do boys and girls. You can do whatever way you want. One team drinks every time Sting says Roxanne. And one team drinks every time they sing put on the red light.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would ruin you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's class.
But
so I think there's a nub of what you're saying. Live Aid certainly made more people than ever before hear and listen to a Dublin accent.
Yes, it did. And it's hard to know that we think about, say, well, my point is, when we look at Irish identity and its relationship with the Irish language, the 80s, and particularly the U2 era, was a point when people started saying, we don't see Irishness as these particular things anymore. We start to see ourselves as the global island, everyone's best friend. The U2, Italia 90, Riverdance kind of trajectory was the high point of cultural cringe. And then after that, we started actually revisiting Irish. You started seeing Irish pop acts incorporate bits of Irish music afterwards.
Do you think Riverdance was a high point in cultural cringe?
I think it was the turning point when the cultural cringe was dropping. Point.
Yeah, 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 it was definitely, it was the sea change.
And I think this is the
it
thing.
It was the holy fuck, I did not know Irish dancing could be sexy. That was the moment. Like, that was it. Like, because the 70s, Irish music, popular Irish music in the 70s was the Dubliners, the Clancy Brothers. It was an embracing of Irish culture and an embracing of a narrow, if anything, definition of Irish culture.
Yeah.
I mean, when the 80s came, like, we were so poor that if you couldn't play football well, you better hope you're good at music, because otherwise you're just,
yeah,
you're riddled. Like, yeah.
You had to kick your way out, or you had to sing your way out.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And but this
or
is
in
the
case of Larry Mullen Jr., just look shit cool. Just look shit cool. Yeah, sure, you can learn to drum along the way. It's no problem. Yeah. It's like, Adam's dad has a van, so, you know, he can be in the band.
But he is so that my dad has a van.
My spoon.
But I would say, I think one of the reasons that people have a very kind of, I think people hate, it's important to point out that people hated Bonham before the tax thing. And the tax thing just made it easier.
Yeah, yeah.
But I
do
think that we, in some ways, that you two did represent maybe the kind of a certain point in our own relationship with ourselves as Irish people and how we saw ourselves, and that they started saying, we're Irish, but you wouldn't know it straight away.
Yeah, you wouldn't tell from the music, and you wouldn't tell from the way we act, and you wouldn't tell from what we do, and it's interesting. Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot to look into there.
And what Americanisms was this girl using again at the start of the podcast?
Okay,
so far back.
There is another Americanism which came up, and this also has a political dimension, and also has a pop culture dimension. This is the use of the phrase "boomer."
Oh, I fucking hate when that's used over here.
Yes,
I absolutely hate when it's used over here. And you know why I hate when it's used over here?
Do tell.
Because, like, it refers to boomer, if anybody's unfamiliar, it refers to people born between, roughly speaking, 1945 and 1965. It's the post-war generation, the post-World War II generation.
Yeah.
People who were born into an era of unheralded prosperity. You know, two cars in every driveway and a refrigerator in every house. And it is symptomatic of a kind of a generation of people who will turn around and say that millennials and Gen Zers, complain about everything. Why don't they just pull up their bootstraps and work like me, without realizing the inherent social structures and advantages that allowed them to progress in the way that they did, that it was dirt cheap to buy a house. It was so easy to buy two cars. It was, you know, it was dead cheap to go to college and likes. The reason I hate it when it's being used over here is we didn't have a baby boom in the post-war years.
Yeah.
We still had rationing. Like, we were dirt poor over here. We didn't get this post-war economic boom because we were neutral during the war. We had no economy to speak of. We were still a very agrarian nation. It wasn't until La Masse became Taoiseach that we looked for things like foreign direct investment and heavy industry. Now, we've since pissed away all our heavy industry, and most things are based around foreign direct investment and tourism. But we had our baby boom in the 1980s. So yeah. Like you and I, Derek, we're boomers. We're the Irish version of baby boomers. Now, that said, the generation before us, was it easier for them to buy a house? Yes. Mm-hmm. Was it easier for them to have two cars? Yes. Was it cheaper for them to go to college? Yes and no, because we benefited from free fees in 1997, but it's far more expensive now to go to college than it would have been when our parents were younger, despite the so-called free fees. It's just the case that the same inherent social, you know, support structure wasn't there for Irish people at this time. Sure, it was easier, and it's more difficult now because of global financial concerns, but anybody who uses the term boomer unironically to refer to Irish people who were born between 1945 and 1965 is just being ignorant. Like, it's just wrong.
Yeah, because there's some things that you can apply to different countries, the same way that in Germany they have certain generational delineations which don't apply here. And if you were,
yeah, that's for damn sure. Like, for very obvious reasons, like, yeah. You know what I mean. They had a generation that were affected by a nationwide recession because of unification. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, okay, we may have that at some stage in the future. You never know what way things are going to go, but like, it's certainly not something that's applicable right here, right now. But we're a very Anglo-centric culture, and there's just this desire that, well, if the Brits and the Yanks have boomers, we must have boomers. I'll use that term, and it's just so. It's just off. Like, it's off target. It's not right.
Arguably, we don't really have a Gen X either, because the defining characteristics of Gen X, obviously, apart from having boomer parents, were that families were smaller and different because of divorce and contraception.
Yeah, so our Gen Xs were born in the 2000s.
Yeah.
I mean, we got contraception. Contraception was available. It was available in the 1980s. So there's a theory that we could. And it was kind of the turning point socially where families started to become a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Like, both of my parents, 5 or 6 siblings, you know?
Yeah.
I have one sibling. Both of us born in the 80s. So we do, in theory, we have maybe a Generation X that came along 7, 8, 9, maybe 10 years later. But I mean, we kind of did, like, we still had people who were, you know, into skateboarding culture, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, the graffiti, punks, things like that. We still experienced all that, you know?
Yeah, but it was an odd fit. So, I mean, we've covered a lot of very important and relevant ground today.
I'm still hoping we could, you know, I was hoping we could naturally find some way to bring it back around to something.
What we will do is say that in terms of the, so when we think about the people saying men are trash or referring to boomers or, you know, or saying someone's woke, which is, has its own context, does the acquisition and distribution of loan words from America or anywhere else represent a transfer of values?
That's a really good question, because like the term boomer is inherently charged. It's loaded. Nobody says boomer in a positive way. You know what I mean? It's always like, oh, you have no idea of the social scaffolding you had and I don't. And, you know, how dare you tell me that I'm just not working hard enough. I'm working 2 jobs and I still can't afford to pay the rent in Dublin. You know, it's not done in a sort of like, oh, aren't the boomers lovely? Like, it's never done in that sense. So it is. It's a value statement in and of itself. But I mean, other things are just used because that's just what you say. Like, there's a recent kickback on Twitter against Irish people using the term y'all.
Yeah.
And like, nobody's using it unironically to hail a group of people. Like, nobody's going to the smoking section of the workmen's and going, howdy, y'all. You know, it's just,
hey, yes.
Hey, yes. Hell, yes. But it's like, it's used on Twitter because it's just, that's the phrase. That's what you say. It's just, it's this sort of like y'all thing. And to be honest with you, it's a safe kind of cultural appropriation because it's appropriating from the dominant culture. It's appropriating from the ubiquitous culture. It's not taking something from a minority culture and using it mockingly. If anything, it's kind of punching up. Yeah. So, I mean, and that and the fact that, like, you know, the only y'all that's important is in East Cork. We know that. That's fine.
We certainly do. And on that note, on that relevant note, I want to thank you very much, Patrick, for joining me again today.
Yeah, no worries.
Until next time, it's a slán from me.
Like a slán, wham shit, y'all.
Don't be trash. Thank you so much for joining us today. Headstuff have a number of other shows. They're not as good as Mother Folklore, but they might be but they might be good enough for you. For example, one One of the shows is that if you enjoy the Sweet Valley High books, there's a Sweet Valley High podcast called Double Love that is on the Head Stuff Podcast Network. You might also enjoy
Personality Bingo with Tom Moran. 60 minutes, 60 questions with an interesting person.
Give it a go. If you want to contact the show, you can contact us by email at motherfucklerheadstuff.org. We're always looking for content for our new next mailbag episodes. We'd love to hear from you. And if you send us an audio clip, we might play it instead of just reading it out in a funny voice.
That's not a funny voice. That's my fucking voice.
Really?
That's my... That's just me reading.
I thought you were doing a Brian Blessed impression.
I will murder you.
Thank you so much to Kirsten Shield for doing our art. She is amazing. And thank you very much to Brian for doing the production work. He does a lot of work cutting out the boring bits. There are no boring bits. Brian cuts out the even more interesting bits. That we're gonna put
on. The stuff that we're saving for Motherfuckler After Dark.
Motherfuckler After Dark. In the meantime, mind yourselves, I guess, slungful.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Well, we'll put a framing device in this before it goes out to actually...